Hello everybody, Claire here, and welcome to the first episode of Ravenclaw Readers. Just as a little preface to our first episode, if you haven't listened to the introduction of the podcast, I would go ahead and listen to that now because it really sets the groundwork for what we are doing with this series. But as just a little quick intro, we'll be looking at Harry Potter in the literary tradition, which means we will be paralleling every chapter with a particular text that's considered a classic of literature. And you will soon hear the voices of me and Ella, who are veteran Harry Potter fans. We have read the series multiple times over, and Paul, who is a first-time reader, although he has seen the films, but only when they came out. So he remembers the big stuff, but is very lost on the little details. So that's just where we are all coming from, and I really hope that you enjoy this series. And now into the episode. Hello readers, and welcome to the Ravenclaw Readers with me, Claire.
And Ella.
And Paul.
So for our first week, we will be looking at the biblical story of Cain and Abel in relation to the first chapter of Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone, The Boy Who Lived. The story of Cain and Abel comes from the book of Genesis, the first book of the Old Testament. We'll get into a summary of that in a bit, but first of all, we'll remind everyone what happens in the first chapter. And Ella has a little summary for us. So do you want to remind us, please?
Disclaimer, everybody, there will be spoilers in this podcast.
Okay, so our story begins with the Dursleys, who like to think that they are perfectly normal, thank you very much. Vernon is on his way to his job when he encounters, unbeknownst to him, wizards celebrating in the street at the news of the downfall of Lord Voldemort. Professor McGonagall, meanwhile, is standing guard at Privet Drive in cat form. Dumbledore comes to meet her at night, and they discuss the disappearance of Voldemort, the deaths of Lily and James, and Harry's improbable survival. Hagrid arrives at number 4 bearing baby Harry, who is left on the Dursleys' doorstep with a note from Dumbledore.
Oh, thank you. That was so lovely. I'll just give a very brief summary of the story of Cain and Abel, and then I will talk a little bit about why I decided to put this as the parallel text for this chapter. So, Cain and Abel, a summary. In this biblical tale, we encounter a story of a brother killing a brother. Cain and Abel both deliver an offering to God. However, God favours Abel's offering. As a result, Cain becomes jealous and kills his brother, Abel. Once God has discovered this murder, Cain is condemned to roam the world as, quote, a fugitive and a vandal. However, Cain pleads with God, saying that he will be killed, and so God bestows him with an identifiable mark and promises that, quote, whosoever slayeth Cain, vengeance shall be taken on him sevenfold. And then Cain leaves, quote, the presence of the Lord to wander the land alone. And why I chose this as the secondary text, I think initially it might seem a bit puzzling, but this is why when I reread this chapter, I find really it's very different experience when you've read the rest of the series. The murder of Abel at the hands of Cain is often thought of as the original murder. I wanted to consider what it would mean to think of Voldemort's killing of Lily and James in this way. For all the hilarity of the first chapter, with the shenanigans of the magical community and the displeased Uncle Vernon, this chapter is full of heartbreak and sorrow. Obviously, Voldemort's attempted killing of Harry and his ultimate failure to carry out the murder is the starting point of the story, but the crux of Harry's emotional journey is that Voldemort killed his parents. For Harry personally, as well as for his story, the deaths of Lily and James are the first murder. And I want to think about how this notion feeds into the rest of the series and how it's kind of brought to light in this first chapter.
Okay, so I mean, there's this immediate parallel between Cain and Harry Potter, in that they're both sort of marked and they're both identified by this mark. So you know, it's an identifying symbol for Harry, and then for Cain it's also an identifier, so he doesn't you know, people know he will be punished for murdering him.
Okay, so why I think that's interesting, that you initially jump straight to the mark, because my reading of that story has to do with the murders. But the fact that the mark is put upon Cain, but Cain is the villain, right? Yeah. So what do we make of that? Because I see loads of parallels between Cain and Voldemort, because Cain is the one who kills his brother, just as Voldemort kills like Harry's parents and tries to kill him. And then he's the one who is banished in a similar way to Voldemort, which I think is a really interesting parallel there. But then, of course, when you mentioned the mark, and that's what kind of I thought was an interesting turn, is that that parallels Harry. So
Harry is also banished. He's banished from the world of wizards until he's old enough. Until he's ready to take it is what Dumbledore means. The responsibility of having... Yes, of having killed Voldemort.
Okay, you know, I love that you pointed that out, because this is so funny, especially as you have not read the books before, because I made a note next to that. So this is when Dumbledore is talking to Professor McGonagall and Hagrid has just delivered baby Harry. And McGonagall is saying, you know, these people will never understand him. They're muggles. They don't understand, you know, our world. And Dumbledore says... that Harry will be, quote, famous for something he won't even remember. Can you see how much better off he'll be growing up away from all that until he's ready to take it? And I underlined the until he's ready to take it, because I think it's so interesting that you picked up on that, because I think that is such a Dumbledore thing. Like, his whole point, especially for the early books, is that he doesn't tell Harry a lot of information because he doesn't think he's ready to hear it. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, he also says scars can be useful. He'll have the scar forever, but the scars can be useful. What exactly does he mean by that?
One of the big parallels that I spotted is that, in a sense, Cain kind of asks for his mark. Yes. And for him, it's kind of a form of protection, because it will stop people killing him. He's identified so that he can be protected, whereas Harry never asked to be marked. And it kind of marks him out almost as a target, because... Yeah. He's always recognisable when he's got it. And we see in the later books that it's, you know, a big identifying feature when he's on the run and people, like, look out for the lightning scar. That's Harry Potter. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of like parallels and opposites in the way that they're marked is one thing that I noticed, which is interesting because their circumstances are kind of opposite as well. They're both kind of, like, universally recognised as kind of, like, the man who killed and the boy who lived. It's like...
Oh, I love kind of, that.
Yeah.
Oh, that's such a nice turn of phrase. The man who killed and the boy who lived. That's poetic.
I was looking through Instagram this morning, and I follow some accounts which called Paint Guide, and they show paintings. Mm-hmm. And they showed that fame on... they showed two pictures side by side. One was that famous one of Dante and Virgil in Hell by Bergerac, and then comparing it to an image by George Bellows. It's a taking of the form, but it's sort of the characters are inverted. But it immediately identifies, you know, the images are so strikingly similar, but it's an inversion of it. So it's still sort of like what you were saying, absolutely. The boy who lived and the man who killed.
That brings me back to... when we're talking about like parallels and differences, reading the secondary text just raises so many of these weird questions, because I was thinking about the Cain Voldemort parallels, particularly with a banishment. There was this one line that really struck me. Okay, so this is what Professor McGonagall is asking. At this point, she's asking Dumbledore, is it true that Lily and James are dead? And that, you know, there's this rumor that Harry survived. And she says... Professor McGonagall's voice trembled as she went on. That's not all. They're saying he tried to kill the Potter's son, Harry, but he couldn't. He couldn't kill that little boy. No one knows why or how, but they're saying that when he couldn't kill Harry Potter, Voldemort's power somehow broke, and that's why he's gone. And I thought that word, like his power broke, is... I don't really know how to kind of interpret that. It's such a violent kind of idea. It made me think of like how that breaking casts Voldemort out, which is why I consider the Cain Voldemort parallels, but you mentioned the Harry Cain parallels about like this kind of banishment as well.
I think just from a sort of it does very quickly establish the fact that although there is a secret magic world, it is not a world that is beyond death. Death is still a very real and unavoidable thing in this wizard world. Like, this is the boy who survived death.
Mm-hmm. This is a a world that has an afterlife, and it is explicitly told that there's some kind of afterlife, although it's not, we don't really know what it is, because we only see the people who can kind of haven't passed on properly, and then there's obviously a little bit in Deathly Hallows as well that we can get to, because no one can explain why Harry, except for Dumbledore, obviously he has his thoughts, and in a way, he's able to explain it, but for most people this is just like this bizarre freak miraculous occurrence.
Yeah, I think that is a really interesting point. And one of the things that really kind of struck me about this chapter is kind of the juxtaposition between like murder and celebration.
Yes.
Because the wizards that we're seeing in the street are celebrating. And yes, it is the downfall of Voldemort, but that only came about after he'd murdered Lily and James. So it's kind of like, you know, can murder ever be a cause for celebration? Because it seems in this sense that they are celebrating that.
Yeah, I know. That's why this chapter is really weird on a reread, because you start off and it's got that amazing first line about the Dursleys being perfectly normal in every way. It's such a brilliant opening. And so the first like half or so of this chapter is very comical, it's very light, and it's very silly and fun. And it's always kind of funny to see Uncle Vernon so flustered. But then there's just this real darkness. It's like once the night hits, Dumbledore comes in with the deluminator and he takes the light from the street lamps. And then in him taking the light from the street lamps, it's like the light almost, there's a bit of still humor in it, but it's like that kind of light airiness from the earlier part of the chapter gets taken away when you find out about these killings. But then, I don't know, to return to that idea of like, can murder be celebrated?
I think they're and even a typical Irish funeral would start in the church and end in the pub. It becomes a sort of celebration. Mm-hmm. The agony of death is overcome by those who survive it. Harry Potter is famous because he sort of confronted death and survived. The boy who lived, obviously. Mm. And the spirit of the you know, he is almost like a miracle. He's like a sacred object in which all, everyone's hopes and dreams and the fulfillment of their life is sort of in this child. And Dumbledore identifies that. I suppose what we haven't spoken about is Cain's motivation
for killing Abel,
which was a... Do you have any thoughts on...
I'm kind of not really sure about that. It just felt like it... Not necessarily that it even had any motivation, just that it was like a spur of the moment, impulse, anger just boiled over, which is completely the opposite of Voldemort's motivation, because of course he heard the prophecy and he'd been planning exactly how he was going to murder.
Yeah.
Is that how you read it, Claire?
I don't know. I agree that Cain and Abel's story is... because of the fact that it is a text from the Old Testament. And basically, what wasn't just written by the hand of one person. I mean, obviously, there's scribes who wrote down these stories. But... the story itself is so old and it's got so many retellings, you don't actually get an insight into Cain and Abel as characters in the same way that we like completely do with so many people in Harry Potter. And the characters, like even the side characters in Harry Potter, can be really like, there's so much depth to them, but with Cain and Abel we don't get that insight. So it does seem a bit strange when Cain murders Abel, because on the one hand it seems almost trivial. The only motivation I could see is that it's basically caused by jealousy.
But just the idea that perhaps that it wasn't intentional on Cain's part, in that we actually kind of saw him repent of his murder, because his exile in a way was something he sort of wanted imposed on himself. He just wanted to get away from it all and sort of forget about what he'd done. And of course, then what we see is that, you know, Cain gets married and has children and his children have children, and it just sort of fizzles out into nothing.
But it does, it also lasts forever. Like
it,
the scar,
it does.
He has it for,
yes.
He has the identifying scar forever.
That is true. That's true.
But I think that is important in when you're considering his progeny, that his, you know, the going, like this is a, it's similar to the original sin of
yes.
Adam and Eve.
Okay, I'm going to read this out because I think this is an important bit from Cain and Abel. So And the Lord saith unto Cain, Where is Abel thy brother? And he said, I know not. Am I my brother's keeper? And he said, What hast thou done? The voice of thy brother's blood crieth unto me from the ground. And now art thou cursed from the earth, which hath opened her mouth to receive thy brother's blood from thy hand. When thou tillest the ground, it shall not henceforth yield unto thee her strength. A fugitive and a vagabond shalt thou be in the earth. It's like the land itself turns against Cain.
That does remind me a little bit of Harry's situation. In the same way that Harry lived in a magical world and he was then exiled into a non-magical world, Cain, the fruits, he has to labor for the fruits of the land now. And when he re-enters the magical world into Hogwarts, it is as a vagrant, as a vagabond. He's homeless. I mean, he lives with the Dursleys, but...
He might as well be homeless living with the Dursleys.
But he's an outsider, and he does that experience of Cain. It does run parallel with that of Harry.
What are some kind of parallels with Voldemort? Like,
yeah, there's so many of these double parallels. Yeah, I hadn't even noticed all the differences.
Cast into exile because he's lost his physical body. He's living in a kind of massively reduced form. He's off wandering somewhere in some forest in Albania until he finds a willing human host who will take him on. So in many respects...
It's so messed up.
Yeah.
We will get to that, but it is messed up with Quirrell, man.
So he's really kind of in, you know, a kind of forced state of exile as well, and also living in this reduced circumstances in a different way from Cain and Harry, but still reduced circumstances.
Basically, there's two different forms of suffering and these two different forms of exile that are happening because Voldemort killed these people. I know this was ages ago, but I still want to go back to this idea of, can you celebrate a murder? And that's just, I think that's such a tough question, because you, Paul, mentioned that going to the Irish pub and everyone's laughing and joking at funerals, and that's very true. And it can be a really beautiful way of celebrating someone's life. But I have been to the funeral of a young person who was actually 21, who was the same age as Lily and James when they were killed. And there was a bit of joking and a bit of laughing, but it is a very different experience. I think I'm going to come back to this in later chapters when we find out more about Lily and James, and, you know, when we start talking about all that backstory and that history there, because that kind of loss of life is so tragic. Then again, it's this idea of like celebrating murder. If that murder hadn't happened, Voldemort would still be around. So how can you help but not celebrate it? That just seems so dark.
Unless we are making this too dark, because in a way, you know, they're not celebrating murder as such. They're kind of celebrating Harry's survival and Voldemort's downfall.
Yeah, as Paul was saying. Yeah,
inadvertently, they're celebrating murder, but because murder was a kind of factor that came into that.
Yeah, and they're not thinking about the murder.
They're not.
The people who are thinking about the murder are like Professor McGonagall and Hagrid.
But I think those people who will actually have a very close emotional tie with Harry, they are the ones who are really thinking about that, because that's more of the emotional toll that it will have for the future. Whereas for the wizards who don't really know Harry, they can distance themselves from that emotional side and just see kind of like, Voldemort's gone, our lives will be better.
Yeah, and I think that that's kind of like fair enough. So yeah, I think we just have to like make that distinction. I think that's the only way we can understand that, to just see that people don't necessarily think of the whole picture, and maybe they shouldn't. There is a cause of celebration, just as there is a cause for mourning as well. So yeah. Wait, is there anything else that anyone wants to mention, or should we go on to any like questions or other? Because I have a few questions to ask.
Well, there was one other thing that I really noticed that really struck me when reading it, and I'm going to paraphrase. Something along the lines of, the Dursleys have everything they want, but also a secret that they dread anybody discovering, which obviously for them is their connection to the Potters in the magical world, because, you know, as the most normal people there could be, you know, as they like to call themselves.
I love that's like a badge of honour.
Yeah, they're completely ashamed to have this kind of notorious connection to the magical world. And yet Cain also has this dread of a secret, something a lot more kind of fundamental.
That's really interesting because I had thought of the Harry Kane parallels. I'd thought of the Voldemort Kane parallels. I had never considered
a parallel between Kane and the Dursleys.
Never even crossed my mind. And maybe that speaks to something about me because here's the thing. I think I am really prejudiced against muggles. Like, I really do. I'm like, I know that a big part of the books is not to underestimate muggles. Mm-hmm. But I think I do because, like, I'd way rather be a wizard. Who wants to be a muggle?
Yeah.
And the,
I don't know if Paul knows what we're talking about. But
Dursleys' defense, they do pride themselves in being and behaving normally. Mm-hmm. And they have this situation thrust upon them, which is a baby at the door, and they do the normal, regular thing, which is to take him in and look after him.
Mm-hmm.
They become his keeper.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Wow. I love that because yes. I had always really felt that that's a weird thing, right? Because it's like, why would the Dursleys? I know, okay, and we can like get to Dumbledore and his letter. You're just going to write a letter. Okay, we'll get to that in a sec. But I had always found that really difficult to reason with. I mean, obviously it needs to happen because that's how the story starts. And, you know, fair enough. But I think that that's like a boring explanation. Like, you want to look at within the text itself. Why would Petunia and Vernon take this baby in? They clearly dislike this child. And yet they took him in as a baby and raised him. I mean, it doesn't seem like a great situation. There was clearly abusive stuff going on. But they raised this baby. They still looked after this baby. And I always had thought, like, that's a very strange thing to do. I wonder why that is. But you have really cracked something there, I think, with this. Yeah, this is like the normal, this is like the done thing.
Dumbledore's always going on about how important blood is, the protection of blood. You know, and they are family.
Yeah.
You wouldn't think it, but they are.
Kane's transgression, I think, is it's that he sees himself not as his brother's keeper.
Mm-hmm.
He is family.
Yeah.
And if he had acted with that belief, and he wouldn't have murdered Abel. The Dursleys represent that it's Cain but learnt his lesson. The Dursleys, they take on the burden of others, and you know, they're worse off having can you imagine?
This is a really good point.
Yes.
Their biggest fear in the world is their relation with the Potters, and they raise Harry Potter.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
That's huge.
I agree. And like, to be fair, people get a bit upset when you defend the Dursley because, like, look, they were abusive to that child. Let's be real. Like, he was malnourished and all that. We'll get to that in later chapters. But I think that is a really good point. So again, that image of the blood of the land, that Cain slayed Abel and his blood was on the land and he didn't learn from that slaying. Something about the slaying of Lily has at least, I think, Petunia has learnt from that in a way. Dumbledore's letter, I think this can lead us into this. McGonagall says something along the lines of, you know, you honestly think you can explain all this is in a letter. And I kind of agree with her. I'm like, wait, so there's this little baby that you just leave on a doorstep with a letter explaining all this. You've been like, your sister died in this war that you can't even understand. And here's your little nephew. He probably explained something about the protection. You know, we can imagine that. We don't actually ever see that letter. And I'm wondering if that's important. What words did he use? We never see the words that he says. And I'm wondering if there's something in that mystery that we are left to explore then ourselves. What could be said and how the Dursleys, what is their frame of mind? And I think that you've kind of spoken to a bit of that.
I don't think all the letter had to say is, this is Harry. His parents have passed away. I think there is no magic spell. There is no, you know, you don't need to articulate your motivations of you know, in the community. You just do what is right. But listening to you speaking, it occurred to me, talking about the significance of names, so Lily is named a flower and her cousin is Petunia, which is also
her sister
is Petunia.
Mm-hmm.
Potter obviously contains soil, telling of soil. Cain, that's his role, he tills the soil. Is there an intentional or unintentional correspondence? Is that trivial to consider?
I don't think it's trivial. I definitely again, I think this is where these discussions are going to be interesting, because I'm not reading this text in parallel with this chapter and saying, oh, hey, J.K. Rowling totally meant to parallel these two things. I just think it's interesting to see how these older stories do subconsciously kind of give us new...
It's the idea there are only kind of five or six stories in existence and everything ever told is a variation of that story.
It's seven, actually.
Okay, sorry. Yes.
Seven stories. I stand corrected.
But what you said about... That's really interesting, because obviously the flower names, like, we have talked about that before, there's so many flower names in these books.
Narcissa as well.
But yeah, we've got Narcissa, we've got Pansy, we've got Lavender, all to come. Yeah, that connection to the flowers, Petunia and Lily, and that idea of like a potter being working with the soil of the land, that's really interesting. And again, I think that weirdly parallels what you were saying. The Dursleys kind of making right what Cain did wrong, because Cain, the land was going to be barren for him, but the flowers are the flowers that of Lily and Petunia are able to blossom. I don't know, that's
flowers.
Kind of is that a bit too, maybe it's a bit too sappy, but I think that that's a really interesting way of reading it.
I like that. Yes.
Do we think, though, that Paul, having not read the rest of the books, is being too kind on the Dursleys? Because I feel people will have a problem with he's being very generous of his reading of the Dursleys. And I kind of agree with you in a way, but they are abusive. Abusive guardians. Like, there's no getting around that. Mm-hmm. You know, we can explain why that might be, try to understand it, but we're not excusing that, like, abuse.
Am I being too kind? I don't know. I think the fact that they do take him in speaks for itself.
Mm-hmm.
Rowling is playing with that evil step parent sort of trope of fairy tales.
Yeah.
And part of that is, you know, if it's to get the reader wants to get Harry out of that house.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And to Hogwarts. That's where he belongs. That's where he has to embrace all that was given to him at the beginning of his fame. And who he is.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Like Dumbledore says that it was actually quite important that Harry didn't come to Hogwarts as some pampered prince who, you know, reveled in his fame and had a really kind of inflated sense of self-identity. So in a way, it was abusive. And obviously we're not condoning that, but it was the best place that Harry could have been, really.
I think it's fair to have some kind of understanding of the Dursleys in a more sympathetic light in this chapter, and then in the next chapter we can explore maybe the darker side of that relationship a bit more, because we're not saying like, oh, definitively they're good people or they're bad people. I think that there's a lot of flawed mix.
Like everybody,
yeah, and extremely flawed in some cases, Uncle Vernon being the most obvious one, because I feel like Petunia is a little bit more sympathetic, although I will give Uncle Vernon this. In this chapter is the most insight we like ever get into Uncle Vernon's mind ever.
That's true.
And he is actually really caring about his family. Like, okay, Dudley makes a fuss and he goes, oh, you know, little tyke, and maybe he should be a bit more disciplinary. We see that Dudley is extremely spoiled later on. Mm-hmm. But he actually sees all this crazy stuff happening and he's like, oh my goodness, this must have something to do with the Potters, but I'm not going to mention it to Petunia because, well, I don't want to upset her. And I think there's something there. And I feel like that theme of family is so important to Harry Potter, and not just your blood relatives, although that is extremely important, but also the families that you create. You know, we see that later with a lot of different characters. But still, is it somewhat redeeming that Uncle Vernon and even Petunia and Dudley as well, they do care about the family? Sadly, they don't really see Harry as part of that family, and that might be kind of a problem, but you know, Uncle Vernon does care about his family.
I learned that his name is Vernon. It's not revealed in the first chapter that that's his first name.
I say learning already.
Learning already.
Is it not? Are you... No, it is.
I don't think so.
It is. Stop. Are you serious? Does it actually not say Vernon?
Does it really not say Vernon?
That cannot be true.
I think I would remember. It's such an unusual name. Not like a commoner name like
that
Harry.
That is crazy.
As Petunia says.
That is crazy. Right, it says Mr. Dursley.
It does exclusively say Mr. Dursley.
But this is why it is so useful to have someone who has not read the books. I literally did not notice that it never said his name was Vernon in that first chapter. I'm sorry, I can't let this chapter go by without mentioning Sirius, because this is the first time we see his name, and then we won't see it until the third book. But, okay, basically, Hagrid shows up and he says that he's borrowed this bike from Sirius Black. What is Dumbledore thinking at this moment? Because at this point, surely Dumbledore thinks that Sirius was the secret keeper, right? So he hears that Sirius has lent Hagrid his motorbike. How does Dumbledore like reason that? Because that's a weird thing to happen, right? Because on the one hand, he thinks that mm-hmm. Sirius is the secret keeper, therefore he must have been the one that betrayed Lily and James and led Voldemort to Godric's Hollow. But also, he was clearly there at Godric's Hollow and was able to lend Hagrid his bike and send Harry to safety, and didn't hex Hagrid, who doesn't have a wand, and didn't hex little baby Harry. So what's going on? Is Dumbledore maybe kind of half thinking, hang on, there's something weird there? I mean, obviously he's not going to let anything kind of slip, because, you know, he's a pretty cool, calm guy. But I wonder if his like wheels in his head are turning at that point when he hears that. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I don't know. I've always thought that Dumbledore's actually one of the more inscrutable characters in the series, and he always knows a lot more than he actually lets on. So I was never sure whether he still believed that Sirius was the secret keeper at that point, or whether he actually knew about the change to Wormtail. So I really don't know. I've actually always thought that he probably knew.
But he says, and I know this is the third book, but he says in that he gave evidence to the ministry that Sirius was the secret keeper. But again, is that just him saying, like, maybe that's what he was officially told? Because clearly they kept this from Dumbledore.
Oh, that's a good point.
But yes. Maybe he was thinking there must be something else going on. I don't know.
Maybe. Yeah. That is really good.
But I think you are right in that Dumbledore, I guess. I mean, this is why I think reading the book in this way is really interesting, because on the one hand, we could just say simply, oh, well, J.K. Rowling didn't have the whole thing figured out, so she just threw that in there, whatever, as like a little Easter egg. But I think it's way more interesting to think about how this works in the universe of the text. So for a second, we can like forget that there's an author and just think about the text like as its own object, and think about these characters as if they were like real people, and how would they be thinking? So I don't know. I guess the only way I can kind of reason this is that somehow sparked something in Dumbledore's brain, and he might have already had the suspicion that things weren't quite as they appear. But once the ministry came knocking, he was like, well, I was officially told that Sirius was the secret keeper. I don't have any other evidence that wasn't the case. So I'm going to tell them this, that yes, this is what was going on. But maybe then it explains part of the reason why it explains as to when we finally do get to Prisoner of Azkaban, that Dumbledore is quite quick to believe Harry and Hermione and Sirius when they say, oh, look, this is what actually happened. And I think that I don't know, like, so people kind of point at that and think of it as like a little bit of a maybe a kind of a mistake, but actually we could think of it as making the story more coherent. Well, Dumbledore might think back to this and say, oh, hang on, I do remember that, like, he lent little baby Harry his motorbike to get him away from danger. So, okay, maybe this does add up. I don't know. That's kind of, that's just one of the things that I think I was thinking of.
I was looking at this Roger Scruton quote. The ethical vision of man confers value to the human form. Erotic and parental love pass through the merely empirical being whom we hold in our arms and targets the elusive and transcendental centre, the godlike nothing which is everything, the light that shines from human eyes but which shines also from an elusive point beyond them. This revelation of the individual in his freedom forms one of the primary themes of high art. Even just the image of Hagrid holding the child in his arms, and he's looking at the child. He's not looking at this is the boy who survived. His love of the child is deeper than that. It's almost magical. It's transcendental. It's beyond reason. And the whole book, the series of seven books, it's about the revelation of Harry Potter, of the individual of Harry Potter, and we want him to become himself. We know from the beginning what he has the potential to be, and we want it to happen. And I think the way J.K. Rowling sort of achieves it is by knowingly and unknowingly referencing literary traditions and texts. Cain and Abel, Adam and Eve, these are the oldest stories we have, and we're still nodding towards them. And it adds a strange sort of depth and something mystical, I suppose. And that's what we're trying to find in this podcast.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And sometimes it's going to work and sometimes it's not going to work.
I love that we can end with Hagrid and just how Hagrid sees this little baby and just wants the best for him. I think that's such mm-hmm. I think that's such a great place to end, because there was so much darkness in the Cain and Abel story that I mm-hmm. think that ending it on that hopeful, uplifting, just everything that Hagrid kind of embodies is beautiful.
Yes.